This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. We're without Jen. We're going solo again.
Yes. And originally we had planned for episode 300 to be just a very, not as many deeper questions, just kind of fun personal questions. And so obviously we won't be able to do that with Dr. Hawk. We definitely want her to be on for episode 300. So I think this episode will identify as 301.
Yeah.
And next episode will identify as episode 300.
Yeah, so it's hopefully. Very creative. Yes. That's good. That's exactly how we'll do that. That's great, Nathan.
Yeah, maybe later someone will release a documentary says, what is an episode?
Yeah, exactly. So, sure. Yeah. Exactly. Good. All right. How are things going there?
Things are great. It's a bit cold for California weather, but I'm actually really excited to go to Virginia in a couple of weeks, not even 2 weeks. It's actually a little bit less than 2 weeks, where Dr. Lyle, you and Dr. Hawker are going to be presenting the True to Life seminar. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really looking forward to it.
Yep, me too. We're getting ourselves ready. Jen is not bailing out tonight to work on her thing. She's actually over in her West Virginia home working on some contracts with some contractors on some work. So that's where she is. But anyway, that's that. That's what we're, but yeah, Jen and I are excited about this. We're getting our organization together about what we're going to talk about. I mean, we've known what we're going to talk about, but we're finalizing that stuff. And we're also, we're looking forward to meeting our little group. And then we're looking forward to everybody seeing and being in on and being able to text us questions and responses at our big seminar on Sunday, the February the 19th. So hope to see you there.
Yes. And for listeners who may be looking for the link, I will put the link for that website to register in the description of this particular show and all the shows before this as well. But for people listening, you can go to www.truetolife.us. That's truetolife.us.
Oh, good. It's not quite free. It's $19.95, but correct. Close. Yeah. All right, Nathan. Well, what's going on? What are we up to?
Well, we've got some questions today, and and so the first one actually is about genetics, and it was it's from a listener who wasn't taught genetics, and so they were hoping that you could oversimplify or that you could simplify this, and maybe they're oversimplifying their understanding. So it's as follows: Dear doctors, I'm still trying to figure out genetics and evolution since I wasn't taught it in school. So I might be way oversimplifying this. I read that your mother and father give you a set of genes from each of them, but it is randomized which exact ones you get. So if you get a set of genes from your parents and they get a set of genes from each of their parents, wouldn't you be able to track a certain genetic trait as being from either one of your parents or one of their parents?
You could in principle, but you might not know. In other words, so you get a full set of genes from each parent, but only half of one of these things is expressed. So you can't get your mom's nose and your dad's nose, even though you actually wouldn't. That wouldn't be how it would work. You get it's a very fragmented thing. Let me try to think about how I would say this. Let's suppose you had, I'm trying to think maybe beads or pieces to a jigsaw puzzle or I don't have a good analogy, but what you have is you might get, for example, let's suppose there's two different specific little proteins that build the depth of the enamel on your teeth, and you have at that site on the genetic code, you have both your mom's gene for that and your dad's gene for that. So you actually have both genes. The question is, which one is going to be expressed? And the way it can work actually is both of them could be expressed at different times. In other words, genetics gets complicated. But generally speaking, one of those genes is going to dominate over the other one when it comes to its expression. So that's why two children coming from the exact same two parents, they're getting somewhat different genes, but even if the genes weren't that different, the kids could be very different because the pattern of which gene gets expressed, whether it's the mom or the dad's gene at a given loci, that's sort of a random process. So that's why you could get your dad's looks, but you get your mom's personality. Or you could get your mom's temper, but you get your dad's intelligence. And it gets far, far finer than that, because each of those things is going to be thousands of genes to express, you know, something like, quote, your temper. It's not going to be one gene. And the genes could be selected, you know, literally. If you had 50 genes in a row that were all responsible for, say somebody's temper, which there would be more, but let's suppose there was those 50, you could, in theory, get all 50 from your dad and therefore have your dad's exact characteristics with respect to that. Or you could get 48 from your dad and 2 from your mom. Two of your moms get expressed, and so you'd be a little bit different than your dad, but you'd be an awful lot like your dad. Probably of those 50 genes, you'll have 20 or 30 of them will be from your dad that will be dominant, and then the other 20 or 30 from your mom will be dominant, and so you're kind of somewhere in the middle. But of those 50 genes, if your sister got, let's suppose by chance, exactly the same 50 genes, in other words, in that location, the eggs and the sperm were exactly the same, which is possible. That of those 50 genes, your sister could have 15 come from dad and 35 come from mom, dominant for her. So then it looks a little different. So that's why to try to look at a specific trait, it's going to be tough to know where a trait's going to come from, except for the following. And that the thing doesn't wind up getting scrambled gene by gene. Genes clump together in big clumps, and they'll go together. So there might be, 100 of them in a row. So actually, wow, that girl looks an awful lot like her mother. And you can't even see her dad in her hardly at all, because so many of those physical presentation genes happen to be dominant coming through her mother's side, and she just looks like her mother, okay? Yet, if we looked at her spleen and her kidneys and we looked at her mathematical ability, we would see that her dad's genes would be dominating. So that's why you're a very interesting and complex and unique composite of two individuals. So you might be able to look back through the genetic code and look at your grandparents, and you can see oftentimes high resemblances between people that are, two second degree relatives. You can very often see it in parents. Like, so parents to children, you can very often see components of children that are very similar to their parents. And you can see that a pair of children can be very similar to each other. And you can see that one child resembles one of the parents far more in some respects than in others, and the other one resembles the other parent. So you can actually see it at times when all of the children heavily resemble one of the parents and not the other parent. So in those pairings of the observable genes that we're seeing, the one parent's genes are just dominating the other parent's genes. And those are the genes that are active and in charge of building that structure. You will often see that kind of a thing. But usually you're going to see something that looks more like a blend. I use the word composite because that's actually what is actually happening, but it feels like a blend. It feels like they're all blended together. And, you know, dad was hot-tempered, mom was calm, and I'm in the middle. But if we looked in there more carefully, we would see that the genes are actually a composite, which in some sense we could see as a blend, but isn't. But the behavior is effectively winds up being a blend. So, yeah, much easier to see the genes coming from one parent to a child or another parent to a child, you know, and you can see specific characteristics oftentimes. Sometimes you can't. Like, you won't actually be able to know a kid kind of as his own creature, and you can't really tell where that, quote, characteristic came from. Sometimes it can be a little odd because then you'll meet some cousin and you'd be like, oh, there it is. He has the same tick that Georgie has, and nobody else in our family has it. It's like, well, now we see what it is. So anyway, that's how the genes work. They work in a piecemeal, unpredictable fashion, sometimes in big chunks, so people can be extremely resembling of a relative that sometimes a first-degree relative or even a second-degree relative, like a grandparent to a grandchild or an uncle to a nephew. Okay, that's a second degree relative, two steps away. So they were one quarter of the genes are being shared. So it's a big wild west frontier out there, and about which genes of which parent at which loci are going to be dominant, and therefore the ones that are going to be mostly expressed and determine that characteristic. But, you know, sometimes you can see it and sometimes you can't. You can see it more often when it's really striking, like, you know, a very unusual hair color or something like that. So sometimes you can see it, but a lot of times we can look at four grandparents and be just sort of see little pieces of ourselves in those four people, but we don't strongly resemble any of them. And that's because we don't, you know, it's too much of a mix, and that's just how that works. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm curious right away if there are any genes that express themselves differently if there's, say, sufficient testosterone or sufficient estrogen, and so therefore the gene will express one way versus another way.
You know, I don't know enough about genetics that would cause this sort of conditional action on a gene. You know, essentially the environmental, what you're talking about is the environmental impact on how the gene behaves. Mm-hmm. So we know that the local biochemical environment will influence gene action. But this is where we get into there's ways that this works and the ways that this doesn't work. So there's no food that and water or sunshine or stimulation that is going to cause your child to be 10 IQ points smarter, okay, or even 5. Okay, it's just that isn't going to be how it's work. So a lot of times people will have a loved one that has a major mental disorder, and they'll ask me, gee, well, if I put them on plant-based diet, you know, surely that will help. And it's like, no, the diet is they might feel a little bit better. Could be that they would be a little calmer if they're irritated. If they're on a bunch of, you know, dietary drugs, caffeine, alcohol, things like that, that could make a difference. But the difference between eating hot dogs and the difference between eating steamed kale isn't going to have a substantive impact on the bizarre neurochemistry that is resulting in major delusions. That isn't what's happening. So it's a very sort of conscientious and simplistic attitude that, well, now, wait a second, if a plant-based diet will cure somebody's heart disease, surely it would cure their mood disorder. It's like, no, it won't. that these are, these doesn't have anything to do with it. That's like thinking that, that, oh, I don't know. Oh, I don't know that, that, you know, reading poems is going to make your bones get stronger. If it broke, it's like, it's got nothing to do with it. So, I forget where this came from. I'm totally lost, Nathan.
Oh, I was asking kind of conditional situations.
Right.
Sufficient testosterone. Or,
yes.
You know, I guess, yeah, you might have a gene that expresses a certain way, and can it be conditional? But yeah, I guess
right. It
is really, you know, getting deep into the weeds of the genetics
yes. Of
these things.
Yeah, so like for example, to give an example. So you can see that a person's skin tone is going to be influenced by the sunlight that hits it. Okay, so but there's going to be what's going to be called a reaction range. So I've seen people that were so light that when they got a lot of sunshine, I mean, they had a very, very tiny change in their skin tone, but almost imperceptible. Okay, and I've known people that looked similar when it came to their skin tone. But then when they get out in the sun, one of them gets a dark bronze and gets a great tan, and the other one really doesn't. And it's like, gee, I couldn't tell the difference early, but now we're seeing that you guys actually have different genes that at one level of light, they are expressed themselves very, very similarly. But if we change that, one of your genes starts going crazy and producing melanin and the other one doesn't. Okay? So the genes have what we're going to call a reaction range as to what they can do and they can't do. So, for example, you can make a child shorter by, you know, protein and caloric deficiency, and so you can stunt their growth by, you know, a few inches. No, but that doesn't happen in the United States, but it used to in the world where. Some kid growing up in very poor circumstances, you know, could actually be kind of caloric deficient, and you could wind up with literally that caloric deficiency reducing the size of the eventual adult organism. So we can say, okay, well, what about if you have an adequate amount of calories and there is no deficiency? There might be excess, so maybe the kid's a little chunky and overweight by the time he's 22, but he was not deficient. What then? Is there something I could feed him that would make him 2 or 3 inches taller? And the answer is absolutely not. So there's nothing you're going to feed your kid that's going to increase their IQ by 1 point. Now, there's something that you can feed your kid that will decrease their IQ by several points. So you'll lose 2 or 3 points if they're eating paint chips and getting lead poisoning. Okay. Or worse yet, they're drinking fluoridated water out of the municipal water supply, and it's going to cost them 5 points, which is a big deal. So you can damage the organism or stunt the potential of the genes to do their job. But if the environment is adequate and the genes are doing their job, you can't then facilitate them to do better. Okay? So the kid that's got 110 IQ has a somewhat different genetic code than the kid who has 100 IQ. He's just got smarter genes in there. He's just built a little bit differently. And you're like, well, gee, that doesn't seem fair. Is there anything that we can feed the other kid? No, there's nothing that you can feed the other kid. That's what the genes can do. And the same thing is true with anything. Beauty, athleticism, there's nothing you can feed your baby child that is going to turn them into, you know, a supermodel. It's not possible. In other words, that kid either has that bone structure built in the genetic code, or they don't. Okay? Now, you could feed them things that would give them terrible complexion and make them sick and stunt their growth. In other words, you could damage, you can hamper the gene's ability to do what it can do to make the organism to its optimal. So but once you've done enough and it's hit its limit, it can't do any better. Okay? So that's how that works.
Okay.
Okay.
It's reminding me, as my grandma used to say, that pie is already baked.
Yes. Yes. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. All good. Okay.
Thank you, Dr.
What
Lyle.
Else we got? Sure.
All right. Our next question. Speaking of genetics, Dr. Lyle, dear doctors, you have previously explained what is known as a borderline personality disorder, mm-hmm. and how it manifests primarily in females. Can we have a refresher on this pathology? And do you have a better moniker for this collection of traits?
Yeah, it's not a moniker that I would often use. In a moment of frustration with somebody with those characteristics, I might sling out the term and say, oh, geez, what a borderline. But, you know, I can't remember the last time I did that. But probably the last time was working in the prison system, working with somebody who was very unstable and very disagreeable, i.e., quote, borderline. And I can remember one who threatened me that he was going to commit suicide and threatened and threatened and threatened. And I'm like, oh, man, this guy is just nothing but a pain in the neck. And he got off my caseload. 6 months later, you know, he's doing the same thing to somebody else. And then he followed through on it. And he sliced his whole arm open. He didn't die, but he damn near did. And so he wasn't kidding. He was the real deal. Let's see. So what we're saying. So the thing that I, the advantage to using terms like that is that people, including professionals, can communicate a pretty good set of information very, very quickly with a label. Okay. So they can say, oh, that's a pancreas. You know what I mean? Now that one's congestive heart failure. It's like, congestive heart failure doesn't tell you the whole story about that patient, but it tells you a lot about what that patient's going through. Doesn't tell you exactly how you should best treat it, because not every congestive heart failure case is the same. So, but we use words and words are concepts to communicate bundles of information, and obviously they're going to be inherently, words are going to be categorical. So the person's either tall or short. They're not 6'6" 3/4". They're just, that's a tall guy, okay? And it's not, you know, the person's short, the girl is, we're not going to say, oh, she's 5'1" We're just going to say, oh, no, she's short. So we use words to communicate that. We're not using, you know, the whole continuum of that. So the quote, borderline, that's shorthand. So it's a category, okay? So there, so a lot of people, you know, there could be an awful lot of disagreement if we looked at 1,000 people that were kind of unstable and irritated, and we had 3 fancy NIH psychiatrists deciding which one's a borderline and which wasn't it, which one isn't, we would have tremendous levels of disagreement, okay? And the reason is, a bunch of people are trying to, it's like a bunch of monkeys trying to figure out a remote control for the TV. It's like, you guys don't know what you're doing. You're just impressionistically coming up with a label at some level that it hits your nervous system as saying, oh, well, that's crazy enough. We're calling it a borderline. It means nothing, really scientifically. So all these are is they are locations on a bell curve of characteristics that are genetic. So in the case of borderline is the word that you know Freud came up with to describe this unstable, difficult human. And so it turns out, what do we now know sits under that? Well, Freud thought it was, you know, whatever problems in the Oedipal complex and the, you know, whatever. That's what he thought was going on. He had no idea what was happening. So, no, what's happening is the person is very high percentile for emotional instability and very high percentile for disagreeable. So when you put those two characteristics together, you get a volatile personality. And the reason why it's more often diagnosed in females than males isn't because those two characteristics more often are striking in females. Actually, that's not quite true. Females are inherently more unstable than males, but males are inherently more disagreeable than females as statistical averages. So if it's a little more disagreeable, but not quite as unstable, but pretty unstable, we're not so freaked out by the possible volatility of the desperation in the organism, we're more blown away by the rage. And so that's, we call that a narcissist. And those are, we label males with that. But it's the same underlying phenomenon as when they're more unstable and now they're being suicidal or panicky or whatever. And it's like, oh, that's coming along with the female genotype of not being in a dominant position and therefore more emotionally unstable about outcomes, more desperate, clingy, crying, etc. Those are more female-ish characteristics. And so therefore, when we get a disagreeable, unstable female, you know, we call that a borderline. Okay. So the, but all we're talking about here is the distribution of the genes that, that the suites of genes that underlie the variances that we see in between two people on the two dimensions of disagreeable and unstable. That's what we're looking at. So no, I don't have a better label, and I don't like using those labels except with people that I know that they know what the heck I'm talking about. So, and I would never, you know, I'm going to use those terms very rarely and only in extreme cases where all three of those NIH quote experts would agree, oh yeah, we're calling that thing a borderline. So I had somebody talk to me recently who was, somebody was had an interaction with them and they're like, well, maybe you're a borderline. And I listened to what was involved and it was like laughable. I was like, no, that's like normal people being upset about something and irritable. It's like, no, that's not borderline. That's just run-of-the-mill humanity, a little bit on the higher scale for disagreeable and unstable at a particular juncture. That's no big deal at all. I'll tell you, borderline. Okay. So now you're going back with a clinician with 35 years of clinical experience, including, you know, 15 to 20 years of that experience. Actually, 15 years of it was deep in the criminal justice system. So I have literally thousands of cases in my head of very unusual pathological folks. And I have, you know, borderlines stored up my sleeve that I can tell stories about. So in this particular case, when I was talking to this person, I said, okay, here's a borderline. Okay, one borderline is the guy that, you know, threatened suicide. And then it turned out, you know, I knew he wasn't bluffing, but I wasn't giving him what he wanted. And he kept threatening me and it kept going on. And he says, I'm not kidding. And I'm like, I know you're not kidding, but you're still not getting this and you're not getting that. That's not the rules. Okay. So finally, you know, it exploded on somebody else's caseload 6 months later. It was well documented. You know, anybody that was anywhere near that case knew that that was a high risk. So that is a borderline, i.e. very unstable, very disagreeable male. All right. This gal had, you know, met some guy in a bar. She's, you know, cute, met some guy in a bar, starts shacking up with him. And within a week, you know, he's pulling away. He's like, well, gee, that was easy, i.e. borderlines are unstable. So if they like you and they're attracted to you, hey, look out, you know, 10 paid dates, you're not even 10 corn chips in and you're going to score, for God's sakes. Okay. All right. So right place at the right time, you know. This is Michael Douglas running into Glenn close at a cool party, and he can't even believe how lucky he is. It's like, wow, this is looking good here, okay? And of course, it turns out to be his worst nightmare. So the that's how you get the bunny rabbit on the stove. You know, that's the famous scene from there. I forget the name of the movie. Oh my God, you don't know the movie? What's the movie? There's two great movies that are actually the classic borderline movies. And I can't remember the Michael Douglas Glenn Close, the name of it. It'll embarrass me because it'll hit me as soon as we get off.
I'm Googling. But right now. Fatal Attraction?
Yeah, good. Fatal Attraction. So Fatal Attraction is an absolutely fabulous picture of an extreme borderline. It's like, oh God, you know what I mean? That's every decent guy's worst nightmare. The other one is also fabulous, chilling. It's called Play Misty for Me. It was Clint Eastwood and Jessica Walters, and man, that was a heck of a movie in terms of a borderline depiction. So I can remember really well. I haven't seen it in 30 years, and it still gives me chills. Some of the dialogue and what it looked like. I mean, that was a great depiction. So. And my borderline gal one day walks in and tells me the story of what she's doing on probation. So goes home with this guy, shacks up, he likes him. They're having a good time for 2-3 days. He starts backing off, and she's, you know, very upset. Okay. And so then he starts ghosting her. This is the day before cell phones, so you know, she's calling him and he's not calling back. And so she's going over to his house and he's not answering the door. And so then she decides to drive her car up through his lawn, right through the plate glass window at the front of his house. Like, that's how I'll get the door open, Chief. That is a borderline. So if your behavior doesn't look something like that, I'm not impressed. So there you go. All right. I hope that answered it enough. Yeah. I can't remember what the question was.
Yeah, thank you. You're just talking about those personalities. But it sounds like a lot of times people will just throw around random words that they heard on psychology, pop psychology.
Oh, yeah.
You know, narcissist this, trauma that. And in this case now, it's, you know, not this person was doing
yes.
it. When people call someone a borderline, they're just.
Yeah, or narcissist or whatever. Or quote codependent. Mm-hmm. That's another one. Okay, so all codependent is agreeable, for God's sakes. So I had somebody ask me, hey, you know, now that you've heard my story, you know, was this person in my life, were they a narcissist? I'm like, well, hold on. Okay, so it isn't a category. It's a matter of how disagreeable and unstable somebody is. And this person was extremely disagreeable and very unstable. So yeah, I would call them, if I was talking to a colleague friend, I'd say, yeah, it's a flaming narcissist. If I was telling it to Jen, I'd say, Jen, guy's a flaming narcissist. I would say that. In other words, it's not even close in terms of DSM diagnosis, but I know what that means. It just means the guy is in the high 90s for disagreeable, and he's pretty damn unstable, and it's like, look out, he's volatile. Okay, so we're using categories to actually describe continua, and it's important to understand that it's the continua that is the reality, and the categories are just shorthand. That's important.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lau.
Okay. Gotcha.
Fantastic. All right. So now we're going to pivot. This is, you know, it's early February. It's been about a month since a lot of people decided to go on, you know, do some New Year's resolutions. And this is a question from one of our listeners. Dear doctors, I'm struggling with my New Year's resolutions, and I can't help but ask if you had to map out the very best way to get myself back on track or stay on the right track for my health, what would be the best things for me to do?
Well, the almost all problems that are solvable have their roots in the difference between your environment and the Stone Age environment. So if you don't feel like your life doesn't have meaning, then that means you're not pitching in and desperate to contribute to the tribe. And the tribe doesn't need you, so therefore your life doesn't, quote, have meaning. And if you feel lost and no connection and depressed, it's like, oh, well, you don't have a tribe. You're not a member of an interdependent tribe that's meeting every morning and working all day long. And if you're struggling with your weight and your diet, oh, well, you don't live in a Stone Age village. Okay. So that means a lot of things have happened. So we're struggling with our weight. We're, you know, we We are essentially in a semi-addictive process with respect to the pleasure trap. We're kind of in a mess, okay? So what do we want to do? Like we need to do something major to kind of take us back to a Stone Age environment. And so the best thing that you could do would be to park yourself in a Stone Age situation where you couldn't get access to anything. And you would just have to eat the super whole natural food that's there. There's no social media. You're in a cabin somewhere. You know, you're not going to be attacked by the wolves, but hey, there's the bunch of foodstuffs that are sitting there, and you're going to be there for 3 weeks. That's it. Okay. There's no electric light. So you're going to bed at sundown. That would be the best thing. Okay. So short of that, what are the slickest, maybe most effective things we can do? I think that the most pronounced, most effective thing anybody could do would be a water fast. I'm saying that not because I've seen it 10,000 times, but because we know that for probably every major function of healing, the water fasting state is either the most efficient thing or it's very close. And so certainly for unwinding a quasi-addictive issue with respect to food, with respect to weight loss, with respect to recovery of health, with respect to the recovery of neurotransmitter balances to the point where the person feels better physically, reduction of inflammation so that they feel better, so they feel like exercising, there is nothing like water fasting. So I would tell you the aside from finding that cabin or, God forbid, trying to get into True North, but that's a 6-month wait. You know, call up the guy that read this question, Nathan Gershfeld, for goodness sakes. Go to fastingescape.com if you need assistance and if you can do this, and take a week out of your life to turn it around other ways. Of course, you could turn it around. You could throw out everything in the refrigerator and the pantry that doesn't fit, buy a bunch of healthy food and you know, try to get yourself on a healthy track. Definitely. You know, there's many different ways to get there. But the fastest, most effective, most potent way to get yourself to see the radical change in improvement of your health and in your diet, and to radically alter the quasi-addictive process with respect to your palate, your taste sensitivity, and therefore your motivation for eating, there is nothing like a water fast. So I would tell you that, so if you're going to do anything that's more than a couple of days, if you want to do something that's relatively serious, 4, 5, 6, 7 days or so, and you don't have the time or money or patience to wait to go to a place like True North or something similar, which there are a few in the world, then talk to somebody who can help you virtually, and that's Nathan Gershfeld, Dr. Nathan Gershfeld at fastingescape.com. There, I plug your thing. How about that? Dr. Lyle.
Good. Yeah, it's really rewarding to see people go through this process, because when I was running my Fasting mm-hmm. Escape, the actual physical clinic, people would come in and they would do the fast. We'd do some cooking demos, kind of very similar things, and they had a really good time. And then they'd go home, and they obviously struggle with the remote fasting. We've added in cooking classes too. So videos where people essentially have to do the refeeding themselves, and I walk them through it every day, but they do it themselves. So they get actually hands-on experience to do this. And very often after just a week or 10-day fast, people are now, after the fast, they have 4 or 5 days under their belt of refeeding, where they've actually done the food, prepped the food themselves, and now they're back on track.
Yes. Fabulous. Really good. Yeah, so it sounds like you're, as time goes by, you're going up the learning curve and just making that program better and better.
Yeah.
It's good. Good. All right. What else we got?
Dr. Lyle. All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, my organization is constantly trying to access and improve group performance, and there are a variety of corporate tools marketed to optimize the effectiveness of work. Is this bunk, or mm-hmm. does this have any relevance? To me, this all boils down to individual relationships and the big five personality traits, and that these tools and group sessions are just a way for extroverted and maybe slightly open people to get together. More broadly, what do you think of organizational psychology, and does this relate?
Yeah. We're educating our little corner of the world, Nathan, and so people smelling the BS. Like they, these kinds of things, to the best of my knowledge, they're just basically bunk, and it's exactly what this person is sniffing, which is that, you know, the more extroverted, more pushy, grandstanding, and sociable people. This is an excuse to not actually go and produce anything in the work, but we feel better. So isn't that a good thing? I don't know. Ask the stockholders. You know what I mean? They don't really care. There is no team building process per se that is outside of the issues about how the motivational process and esteem processes are structured within the personalities and the job of the team itself. So you're not going to say, oh, well, now we're going to go and have a team building, you know, weekend, and oh, that's going to make things a whole bunch better. It's ridiculous. Of course it's not. So what's going to make things better, if anything, is somebody that's smart enough to diagnose, if you were to understand what that team is supposed to be doing, and get inside and figure out what the constraints are of their ability to do the job better. Where is there a lack of motivation? You know, where is there a lack of talent? And so those are the things that we would be attempting to address, is to try to figure that out. Where is there either a lack of talent, motivation, or optimal communication and triaging of who should be doing what? In other words, it's a resource management problem, and so all of those are the factors that are in play, not whether we got a bunch of people to play patty cake together for a couple of days in Vegas or somewhere and take off work for 4 hours to share our feelings and blah, like this is all just BS. And so, yeah, drink alcohol. So I think I actually read sometime, ironically, you know, I don't believe that I almost ever read anything anywhere near this arena, but I actually read, I believe, credible research sometime in the last 4 months. I read a major review of all of that kind of stuff, and it said bogus. Nothing is accomplished. Okay, so this reminds me of my commentary about, you know, and my understanding and knowledge about the concept of trauma, and that no, trauma isn't the reason why you're having the problem that you're having. Now, once in a blue moon, it is. Okay, so I had a woman that had, you know, was experiencing a lot of anxiety, couldn't sleep at night, had to have her boyfriend there. And she had been the victim of a sexual assault 15 years earlier, and it had never decayed. Now, in the vast, overwhelming, vast majority of women, that's going to go through a two-year decay function. So we know this. We've got great empirical research on this, just as you would expect it to be. So, you know, in the original conditioning experiments, i.e. the learning experiments of Pavlov, you know, he figured out, ring the bell, feed the dog at the same time, ring the bell, feed the dog at the same time, ring the bell, feed the dog at the same time. You do that for long enough, when you ring the bell, the dog will salivate even though there's no food there, okay? But then if you ring the bell and don't feed him again, and then ring the bell and don't feed him again, and then ring the bell and don't feed him again, and then ring the bell and don't feed him again, after a while, he won't be salivating when you ring the bell. Why? Well, Pavlov called it extinction, which is fine, but we could actually call it relearning. Okay, in other words, they're learning that, oh, now the contingency doesn't fit. Okay, so almost always that if you've had something bad happen to you, you will immediately run a correlation coefficient between that and salient aspects of the environment, i.e. the guy that did this to you, that beat you up or assaulted you in some way, or, you know, what smell was in the air at the time when all hell broke loose, or, you know, the earthquake or whatever. Okay. So you'll run that contingency and you'll be sensitive to those contingencies that when you see them in the future again, you'll be vigilant and alerted. But if it turns out that, you know, big guys with red beards with low voices, you know, the first few times it's making you uneasy because that's the guy that did something bad. But 3-4 years later, you've now interacted with 12 of those guys and nothing even remotely happened that was even 1 inch out of line. So we have rung the bell and not brought the food with it. And so pretty soon the system uncouples those two contingencies. Largely, not entirely. In other words, there's still a bit of a memory connection out there in the mist to be retrieved later, if need be, if it starts to reemerge. But in other words, the anxiety reactions quiet very, very, very substantially, just as you would expect them to. The mind is an adaptive work. It's designed by nature to optimally organize behavior. Well, so of course, if it can learn to be upset about something, it can unlearn to be upset about it as well. Of course it can, and it does, okay? But is that true in every single case? No. There are going to be, you know, individuals for their own particularized reasons that are going to be hypersensitive, and this is going to be known in the law as the eggshell plaintiff. So if there's a lady with severe osteoporosis in front of you, and you barely tap her bumper, I mean, you're going 2 miles an hour. And it's the very slightest little thing. And it turns out that, boom, that breaks apart a vertebrae in her neck. And she's in agony as you go up and ask her, oh my gosh, I tumped your bumper. There's no dent there, but I'm just so sorry. I just want to make sure you're okay. And she's like, no, I am not okay. That's known as the eggshell plaintiff. Okay, and you are 100% liable. It's not her fault that she's an eggshell. That's how the law sees it. Okay, so God knows where this started, Nathan. What was the question?
Oh, it was about organizational psychology.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say that every single organizational seminar is worthless crap. Okay, I can't say that any more than I can make a blanket statement about everything. So I could safely say that almost all the time it's worthless crap. Okay, so I've been close enough to some of that action to know that, you know, I've been close to a very famous, extremely successful, internationally recognized management consultant, and who shall remain nameless, and who I like. But when I got close to what it is that he was thinking, he had some interesting ideas that made sense. But a huge amount of what he was thinking was pure theatrical BS. And what can I say? And believe me, I think this was super fancy, dude. And I think he is better than the vast majority of the stuff that's out there. You know, I certainly went through my share of little, you know, this kind of stuff, and it was always laughable to me. So, yeah, that's what I think it is.
Well, thank you.
Extroverts teaching, yeah. Extroverts finding a balcony, getting a paycheck to teach other, you know, to whip up other extroverts, and all of it, a bunch of nothing. Yeah, let's all go to Tony Robbins so we can double our sales. That's why. Because we'd much rather do that than work. All right. Maybe one more, Nathan.
All right. Sounds good, Dr. Law. Thank you. All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, my wife and I recently moved to a very exclusive neighborhood, buying our first house, $1.6 million. It's a small, wealthy neighborhood. And we thought before we moved here that we would enjoy a lot of privacy and that people would keep to themselves. However, we have discovered to our horror that we have extremely nosy, over-friendly, and slightly interfering neighbors. They are a gay couple in their late 50s. They're knocking on our front door every week or so, either with trivial questions, asking about our puppy, or whether we like some of the dessert they've prepared. We're vegan, so we got to sharp angle that offer right off the bat. Mm-hmm. My wife is exceedingly introverted and has managed to avoid them far more than I have. I'm more extroverted and also more agreeable than my wife. With my agreeableness and my desire to keep things cordial, I'm finding it really hard to enforce some distance and boundaries between the neighbors and us. We share a boundary wall, and to make matters worse, and the neighbors have now started to offer some gardening maintenance on our shared foliage. We spent so much money to live here and feel really frustrated about these neighbors. What can I do to enforce boundaries without falling out with them and potentially creating even bigger issues?
That's a really great question. And so we will try to use principles to try to come about to see if we can come to a principled answer. So what we have in mind is the neighbors staying in their own house, staying away from us, and not being upset or angry that they've been socially rejected. So that's our goal, okay? That's the outcome that we would like to see. And so we sit here pondering what moves we can make to cause that to happen. And what we can feel in the pit of our gut is that we are actually not in control of the situation. So we are not in control of what it is that these people are going to feel. Okay? All we can do is we can try to get inside their heads and analyze the cost benefit of how it is that they are seeing things from the outside. And we can attempt to essentially cue them, basically give them the information to let them know kind of more where things stand. That's all we can do. We can't control if they are all miffed, bent out of shape, you know, give us dirty looks every time we come and go out of the house. That's beyond our control. If that did happen, then we would still have the opportunity to address that. Okay. We then have Now sort of the worst case scenario has happened, and now we're going to try, but we've still got more moves on the chessboard, okay? Now, so we begin with the notion that, okay, there's a difference between the circumstances we're in now, the circumstances we would like to be in, but we are not, and the stepping stones that are involved here, there's things that we can do, but the outcome, which is the neural circuits of another human, are not something that's under our control. All that we can do intelligently is to figure out how to influence it in the most intelligent way that we can think of. So we're looking at the CB. So we're going to think to ourselves, okay, put ourselves in those people's shape. They are, we could momentarily, we're kicking aside the fact they happen to be a gay couple. It wouldn't make any difference. It's important here because it's these specific individuals, and the specific individuals and their specific personalities, are interesting and potentially important to the dynamics of the whole situation. But in principle, that doesn't, other than the fact that we're interested in individual differences because they're important, it doesn't stop the overall in principle way that we would approach the problem, which is that we have a conflict of interest between us and somebody else, and we are attempting to distance ourselves because we are wanting less of an overlap between two lives than they want, and therefore we're going to have to reject them, and we are not wanting them to be uncomfortable. You know, it's basically if you're some girl and there's some guy in your history class that wants to go out with you, and he's asked you out a couple times, and you said, gee, I can't because my mom needs me for this. And then it's, oh, no, I can't because my sister has something. It's like we're trying to send him the signal that I'm not interested. But we don't want to just say flat out, hey, listen, I'm not interested. Okay? And so he has already heard you talk to your friend, you know, right next to you that, oh gosh, you know, I'd really like to have a boyfriend to go to the prom. Like, you know, he already knows you're single. He's been watching you and stalking you all over the high school campus. So he's pretty confident that you don't have a boyfriend. And so he's pitching. Okay. And now he's pitched again. He's pitching again. And you're trying to send him the signal in Morse code, and he seems to not be getting it. So it's a little frustrating, and you're feeling a little cornered, and you're not sure what to do. Well, what can you do? We have to get slightly more explicit. We also need to try to make the rejection as impersonal as possible. So this goes right to the notion of, it's nothing wrong with you. It's my particular characteristics are involved here. That's all we can do. So that's exactly what we're going to be doing. And if your wife is sufficiently disagreeable, then that's good. And introverted, you can throw her under the bus. You make a deal with her to make sure that it's okay with her, which it probably is. Okay. And it is it's a very good chance it is, because it's very significantly true and it's manifestly true. They see that there aren't cartloads of fancy women in fancy, you know, BMW SUVs rolling up to your house, and these women getting out and then hanging out and your wife coming out and saying, hey, Sarah, hey, Sally, come on in. That's not happening because your wife's introverted. So you can say, again, what do we do with people? Whenever you give people bad news, you do two things. You try to flood their circuits, and you also blame somebody else, to blame Big Louie. So you're the husband, you blame Big Louie, which is the wife. Okay? But we give them a bunch of, we flood their circuits with positive feedback. And so all you can say is, listen, you know, you guys are great, you know, you guys are great neighbors, glad to be in this neighborhood. You know, this is, you know, it's a beautiful neighborhood. We're so happy to be here. It took us a lot to get here. And we really appreciate how sociable you guys are, and how friendly and helpful. However, you know, the truth of the matter is that my wife happens to be very, very introverted. It's just her nature. Okay, so she's been like that since she was a kid. She's like that when I met her. She's like that now that we're married, and this is just her. So the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm not so much that way. You know, I'm kind of average. And so, but between the two of us, my average and her introverted, it means that we're kind of reclusive, and we just kind of, you know, live our own lives pretty quietly. So, you know, as much as we appreciate the sentiment of you guys being friendly and wanting to chat to us and check in with us, we really do. You're wonderful people, but you know, we're kind of lone wolves. So just to let you know, if we're not too chatty or not too friendly, it isn't anything personal at all. It's just us. Okay. Now that's about as best as I, you know, can come up with off the cuff. Now, if you want it better, then you might have to call me and talk to me to where I can learn more specifically about those two personalities of those two individuals, what the dynamics are between the two of them as best you can tell, and what the dynamics are between each of the four people that are involved. Okay, so there's, you know, there can be more to it that is subtle and that can be important in devising this kind of feedback. But in general, generally speaking, they are likely to be, as you know, as anyone in that situation, of course they're going to, quote, take it personally. There can be some worst case scenario inferences that it's because you're gay and that you guys are actually gay phobic. They probably won't. They might feel that way a little bit, a little lack of kinship there and a little bit of line, but line in some sand. But the truth of the matter is, that's not even that odd for that to be. So the heterosexual couple and a gay couple, it's like, hey, wait a second, you know, that doesn't necessarily fit everybody's interests all that well, and everybody can understand that. So the so that shouldn't be an offensive process. It also, something else is true that this questioner may not realize, and that is that people that are like these two guys that are kind of pushy, they have had many people push back on them in their lifetimes. In other words, these are personality characteristics, and these guys are used to it. So when you push back, even though you don't do this and you don't run into it and it's not a normal part of your existence to try to hold the boundary against other people, because most of the time you're not cornered, you know, in a situation like this and getting pushed on. So as a result, to you, it's a sort of a catastrophic moment where you have to stand up and put a boundary up. And you're like, oh my God, what an incredible, if anybody ever did that to me, I would really do a soul searching number and try to figure out, where did I step over the bounds? And oh my God, you're so sensitive. Like, man, you're kind of acting like I'm out of line. Whoa. So to us, the egocentric bias is saying, this is really potentially dangerous, explosive, negative feedback that's really going to hurt feelings and really cause a rift. But you are likely to be mistaken. In other words, it's likely that these guys have this happen every other weekend. This is not uncommon for them. Okay, that's why you're seeing it happen. Okay, so therefore, hopefully that may reduce a little bit your anxiety about the fallout from this. If we do this with reasonable sensitivity, we give them some flattery, give them some good feedback, blame Big Louie, and then call it a day and say, so, you know what I mean? So in terms of the bushes, hey, you know, we can take care of that. I appreciate it. You guys are great guys. Okay, so, and then just you can end it with something like, so are we cool? Okay, and that's a friendly end signal, and they're going to be like, yeah, we're cool. I'm like, okay, that's good. Now we're good. Okay, so that's how I would set a boundary like that in place, something about like that.
Fabulous.
All right.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Lyle. Really appreciate that. We got to a number of different topics today, and we're anxiously awaiting episode 300. Again, going to identify as episode 301.
Right.
Episode 301 is going to identify episode 300. But more importantly, we are looking forward to the seminar coming up here on the 19th, truetolife.us. And so our next show will actually be after the seminar on that Wednesday afterwards.
Yeah. All cool. Well, that's great. Nathan, you're coming out. We're going to see you, which is fantastic. And I haven't looked at the weather there, but hopefully we're not in 2 feet of snow when we get there. And we got a nice, neat house to hold this in. And so we're looking forward to meeting a few folks that are excited to meet us and meet each other. And so we're going to have a little live audience there. And then in that cozy setting, we're also going to be able to stream it out. So, yep. It's going to be fun, and my lecture is coming together. It's called The Adjacent Possible, and so there's going to be stories and some very important points that I probably have not integrated ever before in quite this way. And I know Jen is working on something also not completely new to her thinking. In other words, important thoughts that she has about evolutionary psychology, but also not quite integrated in a way that she's going to do it. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing Jen, and I'm looking forward to sharing these ideas. And then we're also looking forward to having both a live audience remotely and in the room to ask us questions and to be able to have a whiteboard and wander off topic and get lost and then find myself. So that's what we're going to do, Nathan.
Yeah, but we're so looking forward to it, Dr. Lyle. And
All right. Have a good afternoon, good evening, and we'll see you real soon. I'll see you in Virginia, and then we'll see everybody back here in a couple weeks.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time. This is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.